baptism. I wonder if you feel there is any real basic distinction between the parties, or is this just a matter of personality?
And if so, what?
Excuse me, Doctor. I think first we ought to understand that the two major political parties, and there are of course other parties besides the two, that they both accept the nature of our economy, such as we call it, a free or enterprise or capitalist economy, with all of its variations. They accept the restraints and the limitations that are imposed under the constitutional processes. Neither party is socialist. It isn't as if there is an ideological cleavage, as there are, for example, in some European countries, between the left-wing socialist and the right-wing, let's say, political parties. In both political parties, there is a spectrum of difference. The Republican Party has its conservatives and has its liberals, they judge those distinctions on the basis of how we vote on some of the more contemporary issues. The Democratic Party, likewise, has some of its conservatives and has its liberals. I think, if I may try to be as accurate as a would-be political scientist could be, that if you were to chart that these two parties, you would find about three-fourths of the Democratic Party, two-thirds to three-fourths of the Democratic Party, in what you would call the liberal spectrum, with about a quarter of it in what you would call the more conservative spectrum. The Republican Party, I think you'd find it about anywhere from two-thirds to three-fourths of it within the more conservative spectrum, and about a quarter of it within the more liberal. For example, I happen to believe that the Senator from New York, Mr. Javits, is a liberal Republican. The Senator from New Jersey, Mr. Case, is a liberal Republican. He frequently votes more like a Democrat than he does like the balanced roll call, that is, the total roll call of the majority of the Republicans in Congress. I think that if you took a look at the Democrats, you would find, for example, a man like Senator Stennis and Senator Ellender, two of the more senior members of the Democratic Party, Southern Democrats, are essentially conservative Democrats. And yet they stay within the framework of the party. Now, there is some advantage to this. The advantage in your country is that it permits you to work out your differences through compromise, which is not a bad word, through adjustment, through what we call conference. It's been called more recently dialogue. How do you get, for example, a Civil Rights Act? Well, you don't get it by having those who are for the filibuster writing it. You have to finally be able to put together a coalition of Democrats and Republicans around that ideological matter. That is an ideological matter. That is an issue of ideology. It's not just pragmatism. And you put that coalition together. This is what we've been able to do all through our history. I do believe that if you're trying to interpret American political parties along the European line, that you'd be very much, well, you'd be very unhappy about your findings. We are not right-wing and left-wing, per se. We are not socialist, communist, Christian Democrat, and social Democrat. We're not like that. We have an amalgam in the two parties. I don't think this is bad. I don't think it's strictly pragmatic, and if I don't sound too partisan for a moment, let me give you an example. We had the open housing legislation, which is a rather dramatic piece of legislation. That open housing legislation passed the Senate after five efforts at breaking a filibuster. I had a little something to do with breaking that filibuster in my role as the presiding officer of the Senate, convincing a couple of senators to give us a vote on cloture. We had to depend on a number of Republicans, but we depended on twice as many Democrats. And we finally were able to put together the necessary two-thirds votes to break the filibuster, to apply cloture, and under the strict rules of the Senate, we got the bill through. Now we went over to the House, and it languished there, and we have to get a bill out of committee, and then we have to get it through the Rules Committee to schedule the legislation. There has to be a procedure. Mr. Gerald Ford, who is the minority leader of the Republicans in the House, didn't get us one single Republican vote that we needed for that legislation. He was for it, he said, but he did not use that power of leadership to get it. And so when we get out on the political hustings, we are going to make somewhat of an issue of that. Now, that doesn't divide us on the basis of communist or Democrat, or it doesn't make you socialist or Democrat or Republican. It makes you Republican and Democrat with a different degree of liberalism of what you think is the responsiveness to the needs of our time. So Mr. Rockefeller is essentially right. We do not have an ideological cleavage, but we do have an issue cleavage. And I might add that on many occasions, Mr. Rockefeller would be voting with a number of us Democrats. I doubt that he'll be doing so in November. Thank you.
Mr. Vice President, we are told that much of your support in your race for the presidency will come from the South. Is this true? And if so, how do you, as a liberal, and in view of your answer to the last question, explain it? And would you care to comment on the candidacy of ex-Governor George Wallace?
Yes, I was glad to do all that you've asked me. I do hope that I will be able to have support from southern states. I'm not a regional candidate. I think this is very bad. I think that a man that runs for the presidency ought to try to represent as broad an interest as he can of the total nation. He ought to try to increase the base of his support. Now, I've had it put right to me, and I'm going to put it right back to you. People have said, Mr. Vice President, how can you, the man that was the anathema to the South, the man who the South walked out on, the man that caused the formation of the Dixiecrat Party, and that's what did happen after I called my Democratic Party to stand up to principle on the issue of human rights, and I've been doing it consistently for better than 20 years. I've led every fight in the Congress of the United States, including being the floor manager for the most comprehensive civil rights bill we've had, and have never backed away from it. Now they say, well, how then can you have support in the South? Well, I'll tell you why. Because believe it or not, things are changing in this country. And believe it or not, the Southern politician today, the man in public office, knows that there's a very large body of Negro vote. And believe it or not, I've gone to hundreds of meetings in the South and they've all been integrated. The South has made more change for the good in the field of civil rights than even the North. It had further to go, but it's come a long ways. I consider the fact that Southerners may be for Humphrey the greatest reward that I've ever had for my public service. I spent several years in Washington being frowned upon, scolded, called a dangerous radical, getting mean and nasty editorials. For what reason, above all others? Because they said I was the radical pro-civil writer. Well, now you look and read what I said in 1948. It doesn't look very radical. What I asked was my party to come out under the shadow of states' rights, which they were lingering in, as an excuse for inaction, and abroad walk out in the bright sunshine of human rights. And then I listed out a series of programs. Well, what's happened to those programs? They're the law of the land. And far beyond those programs, many new programs. And the fact that I can go into a southern state today and receive a huge audience, as I did recently at Baton Rouge, as I did at the university that I once attended at Louisiana State University, where I was honored with an honorary degree, the fact that I can do that doesn't tell me that I've changed on principle at all. It tells me that America has changed because the university is integrated, no longer segregated. The restaurants are no longer segregated. The communities are, the walls of segregation are being broken down. The industries are no longer segregated. This is what I've worked for. This is what I've hoped for. And I might say, this is what I've prayed for. And I'm just delighted to have Southern support on that basis. I'm not going to retreat from my stand. I didn't in Baton Rouge. I gave a pro-civil rights message in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, introduced by their governor with these words. I present to this audience of Southerners the man that drove us from the Democratic Convention, the architect of the civil rights program, but the man that we believe can do more for America than any other candidate. Those were his words. I like that. And I might add, I hope to get a few delegates in Ohio. One of the reasons I'd like to get here as often as I can. Now, Mr. Wallace is a regional candidate. Mr. Wallace takes an entirely different stand than any other candidate of either political party on the issues of civil rights. I think Mr. Wallace will undoubtedly get a number of votes from people who think that we've gone too far or don't think we ought to have gone anyplace. But Mr. Wallace will not be a national candidate in the sense of mounting a major national campaign throughout the nation. He will represent in 1968 what Strom Thurmond represented in 1948. And remember, in 1948, we had a Democratic candidate, a Republican candidate, the so-called Progressive Party candidate, and the Dixiecrat candidate. Well, you never can tell. We may have it all over again. It looks that way. And I'm happy to tell you that the honorary chairman of my committee in this campaign is the man who won the election in 1948, and in my book, one of the most courageous, one of the great presidents of the United States, Harry S. Truman.
Mr. Vice President, you have stated you are your own man. As Vice President, and now as an active candidate, do you feel free to develop your own policy positions? And if so, how do your positions differ from those of President Johnson?
Well, that's quite a big assignment for a short program, but a man is, I hope, always his own man. One of the virtues that one would like to have, and he hopes that he has, is a sense of integrity, intellectual integrity, personal integrity. I have been the loyal vice president to President Johnson. I have been as loyal as I could possibly be. I did not accept the nomination of vice president, knowing what the Democratic platform was, knowing the man who was president, and I'd known him for many years. I did not accept that nomination and become vice president in order to embarrass the president, to harass the president, or to cause him undue trouble. The least that a vice president can do is try to be a member of the team. Now, the vice president of the United States is one of the president's advisors. He is not president, and that's the first thing he needs to learn. The founding fathers had a very difficult time even trying to describe the nature of his office. They didn't give you much space in the Constitution for this office. And John Adams once said it was the most awkward office ever contrived by the mind of man, and he understated it. But what they did say was that the vice president would be the presiding officer of the Senate, the president. He would have a right, he would have a vote in case of a tie, and he would succeed the president upon the death of the president. That's what the Constitution provides. Since that time, the office of the vice presidency has expanded in its responsibilities and duties by both statute and by tradition and precedent. I have a very busy office. I have helped formulate some of the policies of this administration. And let me say that most of the things that I've worked for all of my life have come into being since 1961, starting with President Kennedy and continuing with President Johnson. I fought early for what we call Medicare. I was the first introducer of that legislation, and I was called a socialist and every other ugly word that anybody could think of. And I waited some 16 years before it became law, but I still was one of its sponsors, and it became law under the presidency of Lyndon Johnson. I introduced every Congress, starting with the 81st, every civil rights bill that had been proposed by the President's Commission on Civil Rights. I had to wait till 1964 when I became the floor leader and the author of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and handled that bill in debate from the 10th day of February to the 24th day of June in constant debate and filibuster until we passed that legislation. I had always been an author and sponsor of federal aid to education. I became one of the authors of the National Defense Education Act, and I presided over the Senate at the time and worked to help formulate the legislation when we passed the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. Today, your government is putting more money, has put more money into federal aid to education in the last 3 years and in the preceding 100. These are things that I've worked for, including the Test Ban Treaty, including the Disarmament Agency, including the Job Corps, including the Peace Corps. I was its original author. Now, these things came into being during these last two administrations. And people say, well, that Humphrey runs around, looks like a yes man. Yes, I'm saluting some of the legislation that I fought for 15, 20 years. And that doesn't make me a yes man, it makes me a happy man. And I think it's mighty good legislation. Now the question is, well, Mr. Humphrey, are you going to have any other ideas of your own? I've never been known for a shortage of ideas. They haven't always been good, but we've had some ideas. I have a delicate role and a delicate road to follow, and I share this intimate thought with you and as best I can. I am the Vice President of the United States. Whatever I say on foreign policy or national security, or finance, or monetary policy, the great issues of our time, is looked upon as an expression of the government. Not just as an expression of a congressman or a senator. I've been a senator for 16 years. Senators do not serve in the cabinet. Senators do not succeed automatically a president in case of his disability. Senators do not serve on the National Security Council. Therefore, when the vice president says anything that seems to veer too far from what seems to be the policy of the president and the administration under our Constitution, it does not add to the ease of government or to the continuity or to the direction of government. It adds to its confusion. Now, I have given my advice in this government. I serve as a member of the National Security Council. I serve as a member of the cabinet. I was with your president last night for an hour and a half talking about things that we hope to do in this country as the vice president of the United States. I have to be exceedingly careful, particularly at this time when, for example, there's some mighty good news. I've been put on the spot time after time the last 3 or 4 weeks on, will we ever get any talks, Mr. Vice President, with Hanoi? And why don't we? And why didn't you agree to this and that? And didn't you say this and didn't you say that? Well, how easy it would be for me to stand up here and just be a free swinger and have this audience cheer 101 things that you could say. But I knew that if we persisted and pursued the course upon which we were presently following, I knew that if we didn't rock the boat, I knew that if we had the patience to stay with it, even though I had to be pilloried and shoved around, that we had a better chance of getting these talks going than if the Vice President of the United States tried to wow an audience by some statement which would temporarily and momentarily please a crowd. So I had to say repeatedly that I thought we would get the talks, and I asked for patience. I said that these talks are going to be difficult and long and frustrating. And some people said, well, there he goes again. He just isn't his own man. Well, maybe I'm not my own man, but this morning, North Vietnam, Hanoi, agreed to meet with the representatives of the United States in Paris on May the 10th.
Vice President, last week when you made your announcement that you were an active candidate for the office of the presidency, you were quoted as saying that you are a believer in the American dream. Well, sir, I'm sorry to report I do not believe in the American dream. simply because the American dream does not believe in me as a black man. It has turned its back on me and told me that I am out of its reach. If the American dream did believe in me, you wouldn't have your Newarks, your Watts, or for that matter, your Harlems. If the American dream did believe in me, listen, if the American dream did believe in me, Martin Luther King would be alive today and leading the march on the Poor People's March in Washington. In essence, Mr. Vice President, the American dream to the black man is in reality nothing more than the American nightmare. What I am saying, Mr. Vice President, is that I have lost faith, and my people have lost faith in the American dream, and possibly America. My question to you, sir, is this. If you are elected president, what will you do to restore my faith and my people's faith in America and the American dream?
Mr. Pickett, the only real reason that I want to run for president is to be able to erase from your thinking and your soul and your spirit the feeling that you have. I want to help make possible what is an American dream, but some of the people that have been called upon to fulfill that dream have not done their work and not done it well enough. I know that you're a good American. I know that you're a good man. I don't blame you for being discouraged. But may I say that there are some of the rest of us who likewise would like to feel that we're good men and that that we have something that we want to contribute. You know, there's a word that's used today when you see in our cities, soul. Well, let me just say to this audience, democracy is not a political institution as much as it is a spiritual concept. I don't generally parade my religious convictions to an audience. I don't even like to have photographers follow me to church. That's my business. But I do know this, that the whole basic reason for democracy, its moral justification, since it is not always so efficient, since it frequently is very confusing, that the whole moral justification for it is man and his relationship to his God. The only one of God's creatures that is known to have soul is man. So as I said to an audience of some 5,000 fine Americans yesterday of Negro ancestry, I'm proud to say that I'm a soul brother. I have a soul too. I believe in human brotherhood. I want to say to Mr. Pickett that I'm not positive that I'm up to doing what I would like to do, but I can tell you this, that in trying to get the laws of this country, at least the laws, straightened out on the matter of human equality and equal treatment, I didn't run or flinch or retreat for 20 years. I know that our cities have ghettos, and I know there are victims of those ghettos. I know that the black man has been the subject of humiliation and discrimination. And I know that this has hurt the white man as well as the black man. I happen to think what's important in this country is not so much that you're black or that you're white, but rather that you're right in what you're trying to do. I'd like to think of our fellow citizens no longer as citizens that are black or white, But I'd like to have us think about each other, and not only think, but to act that way in individual commitment and practice. To act in such a manner that United States citizenship includes all of the privileges, all of the duties, all of the responsibilities, all of the rights for all of its citizens, black or white. And I think we can do it. I want to see. And I think we can do it. I want to see a man judged on merit. I knew Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and he believed in the American dream. Indeed, he believed in it. And he asked but one thing, that his children should have a chance to have their education, should have their chance to be accepted, to have their chance to be accepted on the basis of merit, not on the basis of race. That's the way I believe, too. Quite a day with a wife in the hospital and this wonderful audience, these very intelligent interrogators, our friends who knew that what I was going to say in the first place and left. There may be the smart ones. Really, I know we could go on, and I have a very heavy program. I still have to get back to Washington tonight. I want you to know that I intend to be, God willing, Vice President of the United States until January 20th, high noon, and I intend to fulfill those responsibilities. And if I find enough time to sandwich in a few campaign speeches, which I think I will, I'll do so. But since you've been here a long time, and since my watch shows it to be 4 o'clock, if Dr. Harris and the panel don't think I'm shortchanging you, boy, you've asked the roughest ones I can think of, and the best ones.
Discuss the question with anybody, or do it all on your own?
I did it all on my own discretion, basically, my own discretion. Knowing the Vice President, knowing that the great deal of respect I have for the man, and just out of respect, I didn't want to attack the person.
You're a member of this Black United Students organization, right. I understand. How do you think they're going to...
I don't know, sir. I can't speak for them. I really can't speak for them.
Thanks very much.
What did you think of the Vice President's reply to your question?
I thought it was very good. It was the best one he could, you know, forthcome at the time. It's the best answer I've heard. And I was particularly glad to hear his remark about he believed in human brotherhood. And that's when I stood up and clapped for him, because I thought that really meant something to me.
Bob, you said during your question that you no longer believed in the American dream. What the Vice President had to say today, has that given you a little bit more faith?
Yes, just a little more. But there's a lot more to that dream, which I'd like to see implemented, hopefully. And maybe one day, we can really go by what Martin Luther King said, that we can believe in that dream. And one day, maybe people will walk down the street, black and white, hand in hand. And maybe one day, my children can go to a once integrated school. Maybe one day that dream will be a reality. But as of now, the dream is nothing more than a nightmare, like I said before.
Bob, what is your
in the ghetto, that is.
What was your overall reaction to the Vice President's appearance here today?
Well, sir, my overall reaction was this. I was quite pleased with him, to tell you. Although he was late, I was quite pleased with him. Quite pleased with him. I think he's a splendid gentleman, and I would urge all the Negroes to get out and campaign for this man, because he is definitely for you. Thank you very much.